It's a real pleasure to be with you all here tonight and to be hosting this conversation with Dinga McCannon, an artist whose decades-long career is a testament to the power of art making as a means of lifelong living and learning. But before I introduce our special guest, I want to start with many thanks to the team that made today's conversation possible. To our founder and Black Star CEO, Mayari Carmel Holmes, our festival director and former managing editor of Scene, Nihad Kader, and our curatorial fellow and panels organizer, Farah Rahman, thank you for creating this space. A special thanks as well to Touche Williams, Asha Haki Tyler, all of our volunteers and festival staff, to our Scene intern, Fafa Nutor, and the whole editorial team that assembled our most recent issue of Scene, including our guest editor, Daryl Oluke, editors Yasmin Espert, Jasmine Weber, Kavita Rajana, and Shana Swartz. The springboard for today's conversation is, of course, a deeply thoughtful profile of Dinga McCannon, penned by the writer Zoe Simudzi for our latest issue of the Journal. And I'd encourage each of you to pick up a copy for yourself, which you can find on sale at our box office nearby. Dinga, as Zoe writes, is known for her multi-chromatic paintings, textiles, and multimedia works. She is also a writer, an illustrator, a wearable art maker, a muralist, and an educator, and a mother. Dinga is a founding member of WayUC Art Collective, a distinguished group of Afrocentric artists established in Harlem in 1965 against the backdrop of the Black Arts Movement. Additionally, Dinga is a founding member of Where We At, Black Women Artists, Inc., a working group of artists, mothers, and educators founded in 1971. As Zoe writes, Where We At sought to confront the uniquely race and gendered exclusions faced by Black women artists and to bring greater sustainability and visibility to their work. Among their many crucial interventions, which we'll talk about today, were the numerous exhibitions they held, including organizing one of the first all Black women artist shows in 1971 and providing a lot of practical lifelines to their artists and members. So without further ado, please welcome Dinga McCannon.
Is it one on? Can you hear me?
Now you can hear me.
Got you.
Okay.
Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're big fans, if you can't tell already. I want to start our conversation off by going back in time.
Okay.
I read somewhere in a magazine, I think you had done an interview with Bomb Magazine, and you said that you made up your mind about becoming an artist when you were just 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1950. When the landscape for Black artists, and especially Black women artists, was very, very different. Could you talk about what steered you towards that path and made you decide?
I think the basic thing was that I began to draw and sketch, and a lot of artists from that era, we started drawing cartoons, and they had this thing in the paper, if you could draw this, you could go to art school, and all that type of stuff. We did cartoons and pen and ink drawings, and I simply fell in love with the process of creating. It kind of took me out of the world that I lived in, which was not a bad world, but it just took me into another beautiful type of space, and I felt that I just wanted to keep that going. I had no idea that women weren't supposed to be artists or anything about the art world, but it was the feeling that the art of creation brought to me.
Thank you for that. I know we've talked a little bit about some of your early experiences as an artist and maybe some of the frustrations that you had in terms of your initial training. I know that you had studied in school, studying art. I know you went to Fashion Industries, which actually is where I went as well for high school, or at least for part of it. But you've talked about the fact that you really didn't feel like you were getting useful guidance or you were getting a lot of pushback around having Black figures in your work. Can you talk about those experiences and also the shift when you went to the Art Students League and started studying with folks like Charles Mayhew and so many other folks like Charles Alston as well?
I think what it was initially, first of all, when I went to Fashion Industries, that was by default because my parents did not support me being an artist. And I wanted to go to art and design, where I got my revenge years later because my son went and then my granddaughter went. And the compromise was for me to go to Fashion Industries. At the time, I was in a course that steered me towards being a fashion designer. However, it was a very prejudiced world back then. Not that things have changed all that much since then. But black folks really weren't encouraged to go into that arena either. I failed one class my second year, and instead of giving me guidance and support and help, one class at midterm, they told me I had two alternatives. I could either leave, or I could go into a class venue where I wouldn't have enough credits for college. Basically, they were preparing me to become a seamstress in a factory. At that time, I didn't even want to go to college, but I was smart enough not to cut my options, so I decided to leave. And I ended up going to a high school that was right where Lincoln Center is now. It was being built. It was probably the world's worst high school. But because it was so bad, the teachers spent most of their time trying to control the kids, and they pretty much left me alone, which meant I had even more time to scribble and draw in the back. Fast forward, I went to City College for a little while, but I was very bored. And then I would take workshops and whatnot, but I was not encouraged to use black figures. They wanted me to paint white figures, but I didn't want to paint white figures. I wanted to paint black people, because that was, to me, natural. I'm a black person, I paint myself. But no, that was not encouraged. So when I met Wayusi, I think it was a couple of days after my 17th birthday, they were the catalyst that kind of got me started, because they were all about the black arts movement, doing black art for black people, and creating an audience as we went along. I still was in search of other knowledge, so I found out that at the Art Students League you could choose your teachers, and so I chose Jacob Lawrence, Charles Alston, Richard Mayhew, and Al Hollingsworth, and they gave me more support, and as black artists, they understood exactly what I was doing. And after I left then I had enough to continue going on my own.
Thank you. I mean, I think part of what you're saying really shows, like, one, how education, if done in a way that's not actually connected with the student, can really sabotage folks early on, and that can play a huge role in someone's life and career. But I also feel like part of the undercurrent here is the importance of creating our own spaces, mm-hmm. which obviously is something that we feel very strongly about here at Black Star, and that this festival is really designed to support a community of black artists, black filmmakers, and folks really working in a variety of media. I'm wondering if you could talk about a little bit more about Wayusi and sort of why the space that they were creating, or that you were creating together with them as a founding member, was important, and what y'all were offering the community at the time.
Okay. Well, I'll start with what we were offering the community was art by, about, people of color, African Americans, and more importantly, positive images. When we started this journey, like if you went to Woolworth, there was nothing black that you could buy on the walls. And art at that time, it just did not include us. And I think the way you see began as a way of getting a group of artists together and collaboratively pushing our own aesthetics. And saying basically that our culture is centuries, years old, and it's just as valid as any other culture, and we deserve to be heard, seen, and I guess purchased, you know, for people to actually purchase black art that looked like them and celebrated our lives. And also, when Wayusi started, it started on the projects on 129th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue. There must have been about 100 artists out there, at least in my mind. By the next year, the group had gotten down to maybe 30. And the whole premise, we were sort of like right in the midst of the black arts movement, of the civil rights movement, and that reflected itself in our artwork.
Thank you for that. I mean, I think that's also a testament to the fact that it's also important to think about like the sustainable side of art making, mm-hmm. which I think is something that a lot of folks don't get taught in school. Like, there is also in some ways a business to being an artist in terms of being able to support yourself with your work. Mm-hmm. and to be able to, like, you know how to navigate that space. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit also about your work as an educator and sort of what you feel like it's important to impart to your students, because I know you've taught in a variety of contexts. You've taught in shelters, you've taught in prisons, summer programs, so really interfacing with people in different ways that aren't just necessarily a traditional formal classroom.
Actually, I found it more fascinating than my life imagined as a professor, because art to me is a universal tool. It also is a healing factor. One of the reasons I love working in, I call it the alternative spaces of shelters, jails, day camps, and occasionally a school, was that everybody has a talent. Most people just don't know what that talent is. And sometimes art can be, or the way that art is presented to the ordinary person is like, you have to draw, and you have to draw so perfectly, and this and that. They don't understand that art is a huge field. Being able to photographically draw somebody is not the only way to go in art. That's what you learn, that's what you can learn if you choose to go to school in a traditional manner. But there's all the art, other arts. There's the needle arts, there's drawing, there's cartooning, there's crafts. All of these are art forms. And because I was an artist who was able to use all those different art forms, I was able to create dialogues between the people who I was serving. And as any teacher, you know, you have this exchange. You give, but you also receive knowledge and thought. And the people I taught, their lives were extremely traumatized. But in my space, they found like a place where they could be themselves, where they could create anything and any media. And that made a difference from the rest of their lives, because these were institutional settings. So my room presented like a free, open space.
Absolutely. So that way it's a space where you don't have to be thinking about the pressures of the everyday, and art can actually be a space for freedom and creation.
And also to encourage people to, whatever talent that you have, to actually use it and to play with it and to let it bring joy into your life.
I appreciate that. Speaking of multiple talents and also the wearable, can you talk briefly about what you're wearing right now, which I know is also partly your own creation as well?
Yeah, a couple of things. I made the pants, My top is made by another awesome designer who I've known probably for 40 something years, Denise Goring out of New York. She made the top. This is sort of like my signature. I made the pants, and I had a wearable art career that probably spanned at least 40, 45 years. And the original reason why I started doing art, wearable arts, was because I needed to make money. And I found that you can sell art, but there's only certain people who buy the art. But as a wearable, then you have a bigger audience, which means you have a better way of making a living. So,
yeah, which goes back to the fact that it's important for folks to be able to think about sustainability. I want to kind of continue on that vein and talking about sort of like some of the practical considerations of being an artist and talk a bit about Where We At, which was a collective that you formed with Kay Brown and Faith Ringgold in 1971. And as I mentioned a little bit in the introduction, was really important for the sort of lifelines, as Zoe calls it, that y'all provided to artists. Specifically Black women artists. Can you talk a bit about some of the conversations that you and Kay and Faith were having that led you to the act of sort of reaching out to all these folks and creating this group?
The story goes...
We're ready.
I think basically what it was, I belonged to YUC Artists, which at this point had become a group of all males, and I had a child, and that made me unique in the group. Not only that I was a woman, but now I have a child, because the family dynamics back then were different. Women were the caregivers. Men occasionally might, but it wasn't as it is today, where men are taking more of an active role in the raising of children. It was the woman's job. And I found that it was hard for me to negotiate that new role. And so I called, I don't know who I called first, but it could have been Kay or it could have been Faith. And at any rate, the three of us got together and we said, well, you know, there must be other women out there who are having a problem. Let's call around and see if we could come to a meeting. So we called everybody we knew, and a lot of times I would call somebody and they said, do you know any other black artists, black women artists? And they said, no, you're the only one. But somehow we managed to find maybe 10 women. And even better than that, the first meeting was in my studio on the Lower East Side. It was a 5-floor walk-up. We had had a leak in the building, so there was water dripping down, the hallways were dark, and those 10 brave women came up, and we had our first Where We At meeting. During that meeting, we talked about what we needed, and one of the things we needed was an exhibition space. I had been very lucky in that Nigel Jackson had a gallery on the West Side called Acts of Art. And one of my friends, Ellsworth Osby, went and spoke to Nigel and told him that I was an artist, that this was a real artist, she wasn't going to run off into the sunset, etc., because that's what they would tell me, why they wouldn't accept me, because women, you're only transit, you're not in this for the long haul. So Nigel was the first person who said, yeah, I'll host a show here. And then the rest is history. We had our first show.
There's a lot more to that history.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the things that were y'all's priorities, like beyond just organizing the exhibitions, in terms of what felt important to you to do with other artists in this collective mode?
Okay. A couple of things. We supported one another, sometimes financially, because you know money is traditionally, still is, and still will be an issue for artists. Sometimes we would chip in and pay somebody's rent. We would babysit each other's kids, which was very, very important because as an artist, you need like a personal space that's quiet where you can function and where you can create and where you can continue to grow. And this is hours and hours and hours and hours. And as a woman, it was very, very hard to get that kind of time. So my kids would go to somebody's house. Then they would all come to my house, and they came to my house a lot because I was one of the few who never had a real job. So I, I had a lot of extra time. So the other women's kids would come to my house, and the kids would entertain each other. So while they're entertaining each other, I could keep an ear and an eye peeked out to make sure they were staying at the house. And then I could be creating. Very, very useful and functional. And we did that between all of us. Our other concerns were the community that we lived in and the issues that we were facing. And we would do things like we would have workshops, and we always tried to have a retreat, but the retreats never really worked out. But we'd have workshops and things like how to make your own baby food. This is back in the 70s when people really didn't do that. And in combining the group, we've also, Where We At was unique in that, number one, we had enough women who were in business so that we ended up with our own 501c3. Yes, all the way back then. And also, it wasn't just artists. We had businesswomen, we had writers, we had photographers, we had dancers, we had poets. We had a full spectrum of the arts in the group.
Incredible. I mean, it shows the power of what we can do when we actually are working together rather than splintered. And I know you've mentioned other folks that have that played a really big role in that. I know Priscilla Taylor was also a really big part of that as well.
Yeah, Priscilla Taylor was a fiber artist. Her work was incredible. And not only that, she was a businesswoman. And she was the one who made sure that we ended up with our nonprofit status. She was also the one who went after grants. Mm. because we were able to get grants to do community programs, which meant we could teach in the park, we could teach at community centers, and we actually did a mural that we had gotten funded for.
Can you talk a little bit about that mural? Mm-hmm. I know you've done a few, actually.
Yeah, that was probably the third mural I did. The first series of murals I did was on the Lower East Side with a group called City Arts. And we did a mural on 2nd Avenue and, Houston Street. The mural was 6 stories by about 100 feet. The crew was 5 other women artists and myself, and we built the scaffolding. We actually went out there and we built the scaffolding. And we took on a team of young people for the summer. And because, like, for example, the wall was at the edge there, and the scaffolding began here. I remember praying every day that everybody would live, because, you know, children are very active, and they like to swing and do all kinds of wild stuff. But amazingly, we got through the summer with nobody getting injured, and we ended up with a huge mural that stayed up for 20 years.
Wow.
Then, I think maybe right after that, I did a mural for the Studio Museum in Harlem, which hired myself and 6 other men artists to do this Studio in the Streets program. And together we had decided to do murals. So that was probably my first one. Yeah.
Casual. I want to keep talking about New York. We are both New Yorkers, and I know you also spent a lot of your time, or a lot of your life, in Harlem mm-hmm. before you moved to Philly. You've been here, obviously, for 8 years. Your studio is here, and you work here, but you also go back and forth to Harlem. Could you talk about this one particular series of yours? It's kind of one of my favorites, actually. It's called your Harlem Memories series, and sort of what your process was in creating that work.
Okay. Excuse me. The process was, Harlem, as so many of our communities across the state, had begun to be gentrified. Some of the people who came into our neighborhood were not nice people. They were kind of assuming that Harlem was theirs, and that this Harlem was their own, you know, piece of land. My mother had passed in 2000, and she left me with a huge bag of memorabilia. And the memorabilia sat in my studio for like 10 years because it was a bag of papers, letters, bills, and it was too precious to throw out. So Laura Gasson, another Harlem quilt artist, she decided to do the show called Harlem Sewn Up. And I said, you know, this is the perfect time to pull out all of these memorabilia and prove myself personally, I'm the third generation Harlemite. So that's what I did. And then once I did that, I started thinking. I said, you know, a lot of stuff, like when your elders pass, usually people come in, they throw everything out. I said, there must be a whole lot of other people with stuff. And so I was able to partner with an organization, and I started giving classes in what to do with your memorabilia. We ended up doing books, artist books, dolls, quilts, paintings, all kinds of things, and we had 2 exhibitions. And I think over the time span of maybe 4 years, maybe it were 50, 60 artists who came through, and we all did that project.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think one of the things I love about that project is that it affirms that, like, we have a history, and that you have a history specifically in Harlem, which I think so much of the project of gentrification is erasing that history and creating this sort of like ground zero where we can put shiny coffee shops and yoga studios as if there hasn't been a community that's been here for a very long time. And I think that's something that really shines through in a very direct and also very poetic way with that work. So thank you for telling me a little more about it. I want to just remind folks that we are going to open up to the audience shortly. I have a few more questions for you, if you will indulge me.
Okay.
Cool. Sound good. Continuing to talk a little bit about New York, I know that when you were in Where We At, one of the things that y'all did is y'all protested at the Brooklyn Museum of Art, and I think of other places, about the lack of inclusion of Black women artists. And I think that there's something very full circle about the fact that one of the ways that a lot of people have learned about your work more recently is through a big exhibition that happened at that institution, which was We Wanted a Revolution, Black Women Artists. And I'm wondering if you could just sort of talk a little bit about what you have been experiencing with this sort of newfound moment of visibility and sort of what you've really been prioritizing with your work. I know we were talking earlier about how you're not just interested in just showing your older works, you're also still making continuously every day in your studio. What are some of the things that you have been thinking about as you kind of experience this new level of visibility, and what does it mean for you?
Well, I think for one of the fewest times in my life, I am financially stable.
We love that.
Yeah, that's a while. Through the arts, because over the years I've had God knows how many arts and then jobs. I also used to travel from one city to the other doing festivals, particularly in the summer and the spring, all across the country, and that's how I made a living and sold my work. Let me think now. One of the things... can you repeat the question again?
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe I gave you a very long question. I'll say it in a shorter way.
Okay.
I think I would love to know if anything has shifted for you or how your priorities have sort of responded, if they have at all.
Okay. My priorities, other than family and whatnot, is to stay in the studio, because with all of the new attention and whatnot, you can get very busy. And at the end of the day, I said, well, we don't do this, and we won't do that, and we won't do this, and we won't do that, because now that I'm at this point, I'm not going to dilly-dally. The whole goal of my entire life is just to be able to be an artist and to sustain myself, and so that's exactly what I'm doing. I find it kind of interesting that I'm more famous these days. And I always have to clarify to the broader art world that I was famous way before y'all even knew who I was. I was just famous in the community. So now I'm famous on a wider level. And it's interesting, but it doesn't, I don't think it really affects me that much. Because like I said, the whole goal was to maintain myself in the studio. And then, for all the years that I've lived, and up until this point, that's my priority, is just to be able to do my work, whatever, and then not to be limited. Because a lot of times they want to pigeonhole you, you're a painter, you're this, you're that. I don't want that. I want the artistic freedom to do any medium, combination of medium that I can imagine.
Yes. That reminds me actually of something I was talking about yesterday with a very brilliant friend of mine who's here in the audience, Isa Saldana. And they were saying something about how lineage and legacy are often thought of as completely linear from one point to another. And I think part of what you're saying here is a reminder that they aren't, that these are things that we're actively building and can change over time. We might have priorities at one time that might shift. And I'm wondering if you have given any thought to sort of like, what legacy do you feel like you're building that you want to leave or that you want to continue creating?
I think the legacy that I want to leave is that if you love something and if you pursue something, and if you don't mind working insane hours indefinitely and forever, you can be successful. But art is a business. People don't realize it. It's a gazillion dollar business in America. Yet the artists get treated like S-H-I-T. And so it's weird. But the legacy I want to leave is like I've done the books for the children, so that, and I initially did children's books because as my children were growing, we had nothing to give them. I had Dick and Jane. I didn't want to give them Dick and Jane. And so myself and Edgar White, who wrote the first books that I did, we decided to make books for our kids. And we were told at that time that Black people didn't read. You could translate that into, that's a market that we don't think exists and we don't think is worth investing in. because the books that I did, there were five at that time, they basically sat in the warehouse, and then as I went from one end of America to the other, I would sell them. I think I sold more books than the publishers did, and they ended up in the warehouse because they, in my mind, they only published the books so that if somebody came and said, you don't have any black books, they said, we got one. And they didn't tell the whole story. And we put the books in the warehouse because we didn't have the vehicles. We wouldn't create the vehicles because we felt that y'all did not want to read and wouldn't, you know, spend the money. Many years later, it's a very lucrative market.
Yeah, which I think, again, speaks to the importance of creating and also nurturing our own spaces. Clearly, this was not something that they wanted to invest in, as you mentioned, but have now realized works differently.
Yeah, now everybody wants to make it.
Oh, yeah. Now everyone loves black art. It's interesting. I want to ask you one more question before we open things up to the audience. But you've got a lot going on and some exciting things coming up. Can you tell folks about where they can see your art in the near future?
Well, London, but I don't think you're going to go there.
Maybe.
Not everybody. No, I'm having a one-woman show. I guess my next big event is a one-woman show at the Pippi Houndsworth Gallery in London. Before that, I'm having a show at a gallery I can't remember on the Lower East Side, and that show involves myself and maybe about 10 other women of different cultures, but they're all 65, 75 and older, and they've had careers all of these years. I have one piece in that show, and the piece is Hattie McDaniel. So,
do you want to tell folks about that work very briefly?
Yeah, I did a series. Well, first of all, a lot of my work has been dealing with the history of black women. The main reason for that is because in the 60s, when I saw images of black women, they were always kind of one-sided. And as you know, we're a 360-degree human being. And I wanted to show some of the things that we have done and that we're capable of doing, and some of the miraculous things that artists, athletes, musicians have done under the most hardest circumstances. They've managed to become artists and to have sustainable careers. And I celebrate that. So, and I want everybody to know, Althea Gibson, not only was she an awesome tennis player, but she was also a master golfist. That's, I kind of like, when I research each woman's life, I always find out that they're known for one thing, but they are also adept at several other things. Hattie McDaniel was one of those persons. And when I saw the photo of her when she got the Academy Award and read the story of how she was still in the back at the ceremony, it gave me an irony that I really liked, because it's sort of ironic. You're a master, but you still got to go to the back because you're black. And that's what that particular piece, conversation around that particular piece.
Yeah.